Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here. Ahead.
Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Fritz Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Chaim. And you're listening to the Talk House Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Talk House Podcast. I'm Josh Modell. This week's episode brings together two important figures from the 90s shoegaze movement and beyond, Mickey Bereny and Debbie Googe. Now, Bereny was one of the two women at the front of Lush, the powerhouse band that burned very bright from the late 80s to a difficult end in 1996. Their fascinating story and much more is told in Bereny's recent autobiography, the excellent Fingers Crossed, How Music Saved Me from Success. The book details everything from Bereny's childhood through a no-holds-barred look at her band's successes and failures, from management woes to infighting to a stage dive on Lollapalooza that left her in literal stitches. Bereny is about to launch a U.S. tour, her first in a while, that also marks the beginnings of a new band, the Mickey Bereny Trio. Details can be found at mickeystuff.com. That's M-I-K-I-stuff.com. Check it out. The other half of this conversation is Debbie Googe, best known as the bassist for My Bloody Valentine, perhaps the most legendary of the shoegaze bands. Googe was there almost from the volatile band's start, both in their early, more rocking days, which you'll hear a bit about in this chat, to its ongoing reunion. In the long stretches between My Bloody Valentine tours, Googe has played in other interesting bands, including Thurston Moore's solo lineups and with Brick Smith of the Fall. Googe also recently started performing and recording more experimental music as Dougougie, including a recent collaborative single with Too Many Things. As you'll hear, Bereny and Googe know each other from way back, from the days when their bands were small enough to be playing shows in squats, in fact. In this chat, they talk about what touring is like in Europe versus their UK home, better food in Europe, as well as Bereny's bandmate and partner Moose losing his passport recently. Googe tells the hilarious story of her My Bloody Valentine bandmate Belinda Butcher auditioning for the band, which involves accidentally being interviewed for another, entirely different job. Enjoy.
So we did 5 dates, right, in Europe, and we could have flown, but Moose won't fly. Mm. So the only way to do it was over land, which meant, you know, having to get some other gigs in France just to take us there and back.
Yeah.
And so every drive was like 8 hours, and it was really lovely, you know, but just before we got back to Lille for the Eurostar, Moose realised he left his passport in the toilets of the services at the place we filled up at. So I've just had a complete day of like Eurostar bookings and trying to sort, you know, I mean, that we met a really nice guy, this guy Sebastian in Dijon, who did a load of filming for us, and he actually went and got Moose and got the passport and then has put him back on a train, and he's now in Paris waiting for the Eurostar.
It's amazing that he's the passport was there.
I know. It was amazing that they'd handed... I mean, thank God, otherwise he'd be there for another couple of days. But I'll tell you what was so lovely is going back to Europe, I haven't played... We did play in Paris last year, but having quite a sort of extended stay, and apart from eating my body weight in cheese, right?
Yep.
I just thought we did these, some of the gigs were really small, like kind of quite, you know, placed in the middle of nowhere called Levinzell, that was so lovely. The accommodation is in the place where you play, and, you know, there's food, and they've got like, you know, lovely sort of grub that they give you. And then in Dijon, there's like the promoter turns up with like 2 quiches, you know, and a woman there who's like, you know, 70 years old or something, who's like a real old kind of, you know, like a proper old school, you know, did a lot of travelling in Wales and was probably at fucking Green and Common or something, and rolls out some, you know, local tart that she's made. And I thought, my God, I thought in Britain you're lucky to get like 4 packets of chips and crisps or something and some, you know, kind of pre-cut carrots from Sainsbury's.
You have been treated if you've got the pre-cut carrots. I did a little tour with Too Many Things last year, and that was kind of Belgium and Germany, and really tiny gigs, but really lovely people and really amazing places. Like, the first place we played was a little theatre, and they dressed the stage up like a 70s living room. So essentially you're playing in a 70s living room, and they only have a gig once a month, and they only have whatever the artist is can only play there once. So I could go back again, but I couldn't go back as Dougougie. It'd have to be somebody else, you know, another band. But it was amazing. And then the last place we played, was actually a 70s living room. It had been a pub and this family had taken it over and they lived in there. And once a month they turned it back into a pub and put on a gig. And so it's like really great spaces. But yeah, like you say, you know, they feed you well and you just have these really sort of nice hangouts with people.
I know there's a kind of European conviviality, isn't there? Mm. That, you know, I mean, I don't want to sit here like Britain bashing or whatever, but do you know what I mean? There's a sort of hospitality, I think, that it's actually really cosy and makes it really special.
yeah, totally. The arts have been very heavily funded in Europe for years in a way that they haven't here. So, you know, it's a whole different ball game, you know. Probably buying those cut carrots could make or break some club, you know. When you go to Europe, you always get treated really well and it's very nice, even on whatever level you're at, you know. But anyway, you're back and the gigs were good, well attended and fun.
Yeah, I mean, some of them very, I mean, tiny, you know, to kind of, we literally were sort of like, great, we'll play there and that will just get the petrol money and the
to get to the
stuff together to get to Barcelona or whatever. But no, it was lovely. I had a really lovely time until Moose lost his passport, at which point I just had a complete nervous breakdown.
Silly Moose.
Yeah, I only had a breakdown for about 2 minutes where I was just ranting and then he was like going, well, it's not my fault. And I was going, I know, but you just need to leave me 2 minutes to scream my head off and then I'll be fine, right? Then I will stop.
No, also being in a band with your partner, you should know you need 2 minutes to scream your head off and you'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm trying to think when I was in the band with Chris. Yeah, there was probably quite a lot of sulking that went on then as well, actually. Now I think about it. It was a long time ago. Well, obviously you've got Kevin and Belinda, so, you know, but we won't. Yeah. We won't gossip. Yeah. I'm sure that had its moments as well.
You know, well, it had its moments. We'll leave it at that, yeah.
Well, it's probably like, couples, siblings. I mean, anyone who's got that, there's a crossing of a boundary, isn't there?
And it's a very intense world, isn't it? You know, regardless, you know, even without those things, touring is a very intense world. You tend to become like this very insular little gang. And then you throw on top of that, like very intimate relations as well. It's, you know, it's no wonder it can be difficult at times. But I mean, mostly it's fine, I'm sure, and I assume it is with you and Moose, apart from that 2 minutes. But that was Moose. I completely blame Moose. It was his fault.
I mean, I suppose I feel bad because him and Ollie were doing all the driving. So I'm sitting there in the back seat, you know, having a go. I mean, I'll be honest with you, about 10% of it was me thinking, thank fuck it wasn't me.
Is it normally you?
It could have been. I am quite like scatterbrained. You know, I have to check my passport 75 times before I get on anywhere. Do you know what I mean? And I have left passports and I have left things. It's a mind fuck. Yeah. So I wasn't going to go on about it.
But here we are going on about it. Welcome home, Moose, when you find.
But here we are going. But how are you? Sorry, this is being like launching a slightly formal question. So do you, because it is like, you know, if you're touring with the Valentines, tour managers, you know, it's all kind of in hand. I mean, that's why I actually think, I mean, when you mention like relationships on tour and stuff, I do think it's quite infantilizing. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah,
You end up like just needing someone to even fucking walk you to your hotel room because you can't even count the number. Oh, I don't know whether to turn left or right, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're kind of managing, you know, Doguchi or, you know, like smaller tours where you kind of are, there's several roles, really, isn't there?
Mm, yeah.
Do you prefer one over the other?
No, I prefer elements of one over the other. I like the autonomy of doing your own things and not having to herd kittens. And if you decide you want to go and visit a certain place, you just do it and you don't have to tell 15 million people. And you know, so I like that aspect of it. I have to say, I do also like the aspect of being taken care of completely and not having to think about those things. Generally, I just feel very lucky that I can do either, let alone both, you know. So it's kind of amazing to me that I'm still getting away with it at this age and still doing it, still having fun.
So there is a middle thing as well, because you've toured with like Thurston and Brix and whoever else, do you know what I mean? All these other bands where like, I guess you can, like, is there an element that you can stay out of any drama? Do you know, because I kind of liken it a bit to when I was like, when I had a normal job and when I worked in an office, and then for a period I was like just freelancing. And I quite liked being able to just go into an office and not get involved in all the politics. Mm. You know, you're just there to do a job and you do it and you're friendly and then you just fuck off.
Yeah, maybe less so with the Valentine's because, you know, because we know each other very, very well. With Thurston, it doesn't really... Things are, I mean, never within the band. There's never any kind of arguments or anything within the band, really. I suppose because we're also, you know, we were so much older when we started that. We're well into, apart from James, we were, you know, into our, Thurston and I were well into our 50s. So you're kind of a little bit less inclined to, you know, we would never have an argument. I can't imagine. I just can't imagine ever having an argument with Thurston. But I'm fairly good at, I'm very diplomatic. I can put my head down when it's needed. Because it is, you know, it's not always your business and things do, they can rear out of nowhere, you know, and actually sometimes putting your oar in can actually make those things a little bit worse, you know. Sometimes you need to sit back and let people just...
That is so true.
Have the moment, you know, not get stuck in.
I've been on several sides of that where you've got, like, people who start to get really bloody involved and... It never really helps, does it?
It doesn't usually. I mean, there are times when you have to, you know, when you have to sort of step, but most of the time you don't need to. You know, it's just, it is just that intensity of bands being on tour and emotions, you know, and that, you know, you don't need to step in. People usually sort their own shit out and you can, if you give them a bit of space, you know. Most bands are kind of, there's always somebody who's willing to get stuck in, somebody who sort of sits back. So, you know, the kind of balance of bands is usually that we're all a little bit different in how we kind of react to things and to each other, you know. If we all wanted to, you know, get stuck in, it would be pretty combustible.
Yeah, and nobody wanted to get stuck in, it would be fine.
Maybe nothing would happen at all. So, you know, you need a sort of a bit of both, you know. You know, you need a bit of everything.
Yeah, sometimes people can be more combative with each other and then a different mix of people and it's someone else, you know what I mean?
I've certainly had arguments on tour and there's certainly been moments where I've been as combative as anybody else, you know, but it isn't generally part of my nature, for sure. And I think that's why it's very easy for me to sort of fit into other bands. Like, my issue with joining other bands wasn't anything to do with the personalities or things like that. It was always to do with confidence about playing in another band. And I hadn't done that really until I joined Primal Scream. And after I'd done a year with Primal Scream and then I went back to MBV, I probably would never have played with Thurston if I hadn't done that. Once you've sort of done it, it's like, okay, I can do that and I can fit in with another band and I can play a different style. So, yeah, my apprehension was always more to do with my ability to play than my ability to sort of fit in with people. That I always find very easy because, like I say, I'm quite good at just sort of sitting back and watching. And mostly I get on really well with people.
No, and I think when you say it's like, oh, wow, you know, me and Thurston were both in our 50s at that time. I mean, you were like that in, you know, 1980, whenever I met you, you know what I mean? You weren't a shit stirrer. Fuck me, there were a lot of them then. You know, and you were always someone who were like, yeah, I don't know, really.
Maybe it's because I'm the youngest of six and there was a lot of fighting in my house, you know.
Oh, OK.
But, oh, you know, never nasty fight, you know what I mean? It was just like there was a lot of arguments because there were six kids and two adults in a very small, you know, amount of space and vying for attention and space and things like that.
But it's interesting how some people who are the youngest, it's like the opposite because they're the kind of the baby of the family. They get all the attention. Mm. So they're the ones that end up kind of playing up loads, isn't it? Isn't Madonna like the youngest or something? No, she got some massive family and she's the youngest. So I don't know. I still think, yeah, like I can see the pecking order would count for something, but you've clearly got something within you inborn that's quite mellow.
When did we meet anyway? I've had this conversation with you before and I'm still not completely clear.
I went to see the Valentines because there was that whole, you know, at that time when Dave was still singing in the band,
yeah.
It was quite those sort of garagey gigs and you'd play with, you know, I was going out with Johnny, I think. And so I think the Purple Things or the Vibes or whoever the fuck he was in at the time, Terminal Cheese, one of those bands, right? But right. I remember there were sort of gigs where it was sort of that scene.
They called that Club Foot stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And Stingrays, blah, blah, blah. I probably saw the Valentines around then. And then, you know, and then Emma started going out with Kevin. So I think that's when clearly we were going to see you quite a lot. And then when Lush formed, we played a few of our kind of early gigs. I did write it down. What was it? I think the first time we played with you was at the Fulham Greyhound. No, yeah.
Fulham Greyhound,
4th of June, 1988.
Wait, do you literally just write, if you've written everything down over the years?
I have, yes. I'm incredibly vain all that way. I'm sorry, but yeah.
I love it.
A whole list.
That's great.
I can't remember who it was with, but I have got that written down somewhere, but yeah, it's not present with me at the moment. So yeah, it was a Greyhound. And then we did that Yulu gig with you, which I do remember. That was the Sperm Whales and the Wolfhounds.
Wow.
And we were meant to go on first, but by then we had like some, I don't know, we'd been in the bloody Melody Maker or something. So I don't know if it was the promoter, it fucking wasn't us, right? But someone said, oh, well, you know, Lush should go on second, then the Sperm Whales can go on first. And I remember being backstage and hearing the Sperm Whales like fucking going mental, fucking going on before Lush. That's a fucking insult.
The Sperm Whales, we all cray.
Do you know what? I met one of them not long ago.
Really?
I was at some gig and someone said, oh, do you remember blah, blah, who's in the Sperm Whales? And I was thinking, oh, shit, yeah, I remember you, yeah. Oh, no, he was very nice, actually.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, that gig, so we went on second and I think we already had that kind of backlash. So I remember we went out on stage and Emma said, hello, we're Lush. And someone in the front went, oh, God. That was the beginning of the gig. Oh, my God.
And you just kept going.
yeah, just grit your teeth and get through it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's fine.
Oh. I think that Greyhound gig, I think Letitia from, you know, Letitia Sadio, I think she interviewed us there. I seem to remember that being in a Greyhound, first time I ever met her.
Oh.
So that's another weird thing.
Yeah. I don't think I really met her till, probably wasn't ages after, because she was kind of in with, I think Moose and Russell in Moose were kind of in with a lot of, like, Tim from Stereo Lab. And, you know, like, it's so weird, isn't it? Because London is so vast, but it is quite villagey.
Yeah, and it's totally villagey.
Yeah, and people have their little scene. So once you meet one person from that scene, there's, like, a whole load of people that open up. And even when I think back to, like, those kind of 80s gigs, and I think how, you know, pre-mobile phones. I mean, half the people I knew didn't even have a bloody phone in their house, you know, because they were living in squats or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't, for sure.
So you'd actually just go to a gig thinking, oh, I think they're going to be there. They'll probably be there. Yeah. And they would be there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there were some faces that you just knew that were just everywhere.
Was there a guy called, was he called Anthony or something, who used to work with you? Ginger hair. Was he from Scotland? He used to hang around with you a lot. you don't remember, do you?
No, I'm like, Anthony with ginger hair from Scotland.
It was around that kind of really early time. And I tell you what, I remember, like, I'd see it and I used to think, God, you're a bit snotty, actually. I've met you loads of times and you keep blanking me. And I remember going, you played at Dingwalls, and I went up to him and I thought, right, I'm fucking having this out now. And I went up and I said, you know, just fucking say hello. You know what I mean? What's the problem? And it was actually a different Anthony, who looked exactly like him, who was from Scotland, had ginger hair and was kind of wan and pale. And I was like, fuck off, you are literally taking the piss now. And he said, oh, it's not me.
I can't remember him either. So, you know, maybe you've made him up. You're just going up to random guys saying,
I think it was a hallucination.
Fucking talk to me.
Which isn't a bad ploy, actually. Maybe I should use that. Yeah.
Hey, this is Josh Modell, host of the Talkhouse podcast. We love it when musicians come on the show and talk about process, and often they'll get into the nuts and bolts of being a working artist, which can sometimes be fun and sometimes feel more like a business. Well, this episode of Talkhouse is brought to you by DistroKid, which is an amazing service for musicians looking to get their songs out into the world in an incredibly smart and cost-effective way. For the past decade plus, DistroKid has made it easy to get your music on all the streaming services, including Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Instagram, and more. You keep 100% of your earnings minus a flat yearly fee, which is a better deal than you'll find anywhere else. More than a million artists use DistroKid, and the latest version of their app is better than ever. It includes features that make it easy to see your account details, including the money you've earned, as well as to seamlessly edit things like lyrics and metadata across platforms. There's even a feature called Instant Share, which allows you to easily share files with your bandmates, booking agent, playlist curators, and more. Distro Lock allows you to protect your songs. DistroKid users get a YouTube official artist channel, too. The list goes on. The DistroKid app is available on iOS and Android. Go check it out today.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
Was it difficult when Dave left? Because I think, you know, the Valentines were kind of, it seemed quite well.
We had a bit of a roll going. We had a few singles out. We did two or three EPs with Dave. And things were going, you know, going all right. I was surprised when he said he was going to leave. Sort of surprised and sort of not, you know. Before I joined, his girlfriend Tina had been in the band as well. And she had played keyboards. They didn't have a bass player. And she left and Dave kind of kept going for a couple of years. He'd always wanted to write, and that's kind of one of the reasons he left, was that he wanted to concentrate on writing. And he has brought out a few books, I think, as well, at least two or three. So it was strange when he left because he was the front person. So he sort of felt, and he was quite a dynamic front person. You know, he used to sort of, you know, he was kind of modelled on Iggy, really, wasn't he? Kind of chuck himself around the stage. It was pretty much the opposite of Kevin and Belinda. It was really, you know, he was really quite a wild man up front. So it was hard to think what it might be like without him. But we just kind of got on with it, you know. We very quickly went into auditioning people. And auditions were hilarious. You know, we used to practice at this place down in Euston underneath a shop called Transformations, which was a transvestite shop. And it sold like very large and very like brazen clothes for sort of drag queens and transvestites and things. And we practiced downstairs and people would have to go down into, it was called Salem Studios. The first couple of people that came for auditions were so awful. There was one guy who kind of bounced around doing this. I think it was a rap of some sort. It was just like, around the world with a nuclear bomb, around the world with a nuclear bomb. And we were just like looking at each other, not knowing what to do, and kind of facing the wall so we couldn't see us laugh. And after a couple of those, we had a sort of signal system with the people who ran the studios. It's like, you know, regardless of who it is, after 10 minutes, just come in and say there's another person, even though there never was and there weren't that many people. And then eventually Belinda came along, and she accidentally went into the shop, who were, just by coincidence, had a job going for a beautician. And she had done sort of stage makeup stuff because, you know, she's a dancer. And at that time, she was very much a dancer. She was still at university doing dancing, I think. So they sort of saw her and kind of took her to the back to sort of do a kind of interview type thing, you know, and talk. And I think she was very confused because she thought she was coming to do My Bloody Valentine and they thought she was going for, you know, a beautician's, a transvestite beautician's.
I was going to say, did
job.
She get two jobs in the same day then?
I think she could have done, yeah. Only, yeah, it was brilliant. And then she did eventually find her way down, and her audition was brilliant. She did Dolly Parton, which made me fall in love with her instantly. Kevin obviously fell in love with her instantly. Colm loved her because she also had an ambulance, so it was just like, brilliant.
Ticking all the boxes.
She ticked all the boxes in every way, yeah. Plus, she's, like, very lovely. And she knew the band. You know, she had been at gigs and she actually knew some of the songs. So she really ticked every box she possibly could. And she had dealt with being upstairs in a very brilliant way and came down with that story. So it was, like, everything about her was, like, you're in. And the rest, as they say, was history. I don't even remember the whole process. I think we put an ad in the Melody Maker and people just sort of rang. I can't really remember how we did it. But some people didn't seem to know us at all and didn't do anything to do with us. And Belinda actually did know us, but she did a Dolly Parton song.
Okay.
But she did know us. And we also had another guy, a guy called Joe. So initially Kevin didn't want to sing. He had done backing vocals when Dave was in the band, but he wanted to carry on doing backing vocals. And Joe was going to be the lead vocalist and Belinda was going to sort of do harmonies and play guitar. But Joe didn't last very long, I can't remember. I think he maybe did one or two gigs, because we did loads of gigs at that time as well. Do you remember that whole squat movement that was happening in London? So you could always get gigs, you know, it was really easy to... We all played with each other, didn't we? And that sounded a bit weird, but we were always playing gigs everywhere, weren't we?
Well, I think the band I was in before Lush, The Bugs, I think we actually played a My Bloody Valentine squat party. Mm. I have literally no memory of this, right? Not of the gig. I remember the party, I just don't remember the gig.
Right, right.
But it's like, yeah, we actually played at... It was in a block of flats. I cannot believe we got away with that, actually.
It's at, like, on Agar Grove, was it that big...
I just remember being very drunk at some point, but I don't remember actually playing, but we did.
Right.
But I was going to say, yeah, no, because we did like auditions when Meryl, you know, left Lush and we didn't have a singer. So same situation, really. And Emma, who was, you know, Emma was always much more professional about these things. So she put an ad in the Melody Maker and it was like she was dealing with all the calls and kind of... But I think she actually sent them demo tapes so they would turn up and actually know the song.
That's fair, isn't it?
Yeah.
try and learn this. Not just come in and do your thing.
It was just a complete disaster. And I think because you don't know what you're kind of... You're trying to do something that's quite professional when you're totally not professional yourself, right? I mean, we could barely fucking play anyway, you know what I mean? So we start, like, launching into whatever song was on the tape. And I've just got these flash memories of, you know, this woman. I mean, she was really sweet, but it was all a bit kind of cabaret. Right. Oh! It was really operatic with, like, you know, hand gestures and things. And just, like, me looking at Emma in complete panic going, what do we do? Shit! And then we hit on the idea of, like, that was it, because there was a girl who turned up and she was all right, actually. But the second she sort of, you know, did the song, she just had this list of demands. Like, well, how much will I get paid? I've got claustrophobia, so I can't travel on the tube, so you have to pay for taxis for me from Brixton. And it was like, what the fuck? Like... And she said, and I'm a songwriter as well, so I insist on having like 50% of my songs performed. And it was like, Jesus fucking Christ.
Wait, it suddenly turned into a backing band.
I know, it was mental, right? And then, so we thought, well, I'll tell you what, maybe the best way to do this is we meet them first, we see if we like them, we can all go for a drink, meet like four or five of them, go for a drink, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, me and Chris did that. So me and Chris go at the fucking Dublin Castle or something, you know, and we had, like, these four or five girls sitting around. And they were, you know, they were nice, but, you know, I remember some Scottish girl. She was really sweet and bubbly and then just started going, like, really racist. It's one of those conversations. Oh, where do you live there? We're like, oh, Tottenham. And she's, oh, it's full of, like... you know, and Chris is looking at me going, what the fuck? Like, okay, we'll cross her off the list. Yeah, okay,
she's gone. Right.
But, so we just couldn't fucking find anyone. So it was, I could still remember this really sort of quiet, grim meeting in the afternoon at the Black Horse or somewhere and no one really saying much. And Emma in the end just going, well, you know, you're just going to have to sing. Mickey, you're just going to have to sing because otherwise we're just going to have to split up. And that was that.
Right. And how did you feel about that?
Fucking awful. I said, you know, and I actually have like diary entries where I'm going.
I thought you were going to say I actually had diarrhea then.
No, I probably did have that as well. But I've got these sort of scrawlings where I'm going, like, Emma's saying she's going to put another ad in the Melody Mail. Like, I was clearly being promised that at some point we would have another round of auditions that never materialised, right?
So neither of you were like, because Emma is also quite a sort of slightly reluctant singer as well, isn't she? So,
well, I think because I was already doing backing vocals when Meryl was in the band. So that's why it was like, well, you're already doing backing vocals, so you have to sing. But then the songs were written with backing vocals. So, you know, then Emma kind of, you know, had to step up and do, you know, BVs. So, and, you know, fuck it, it worked out in the end. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think there's that kind of needs must element to those sort of early days in bands, isn't there? Where, you know, you do think, like, God, it could have been that person who joined and it would have been a completely different thing. I quite enjoyed all that kind of chaos of it, though. Like, weirdly, I think it's a bit like that now, you know, in a kind of...
Starting again.
Like. Well, yeah, you know, as much as I sort of think, oh, you know, obviously it's great, you know, you play some huge gig and there's, you know, blah, blah, loads of people and all the adulation. But there is something quite, you know, I don't know, I probably sound like a bit like it's a bit Spinal Tap, I envy us, isn't it? It's kind of, but, you know, just that idea that you can just sort of play gigs when you want to and it doesn't have to be this huge machine that has to crank into gear. You can just, you know, like when we did that gig in Ireland together, which kind of was just decided on a whim, wasn't it? Like, we were booked to play that Irish...
Yeah, I don't know how, because you were booked first, so... And then Brian reached out to me via Instagram, I think, and said that he'd booked you.
So, yeah, that was it. And then it was... And then we were like, oh, we're doing this thing together. And then we were... Oh, that was it. It was all the travel arrangements. And then it was like, oh, we could do a song together. But I quite like that sort of... I mean, I'm not going to lie. I know what you were saying earlier about having the confidence to play with Primal Scream. And once you'd done that, you felt, like, more relaxed. I was fucking nervous as shit when I came to, like, rehearse your song. I was thinking, fuck me. I'm going to be, like, it's going to be awful. I'm going to totally embarrass myself.
Oh, you were great.
Oh. Well, you have to say that now, don't you?
Not at all. You were. I was very impressed. You'd done a lot of homework.
I did do a lot of homework.
You were very, I was like, you were like, yeah, but it'd be better if we just actually stop here. And I was like, wow, you want to stop? That's
Ooh,
imagine that. No, I thought it was great.
I'm a terrible one for sort of, you know, downplaying things and going, oh, yeah, you know, I can't really play and blah, blah, blah. But I do think it is that different way of looking at music, that it isn't about being able to do some, you know, wanky guitar solo in the middle of a song or whatever. And it is more about feel and kind of, you know, just sensing how the song is meant to be rather than sort of stomping all over it with your own kind of signature.
I think you're totally right. I thank God it's not about, you know, stomping all over it with your bollocks, because frankly, we've probably come up short there.
No, but it is interesting, because I think sometimes people do think, I mean, back to that audition thing, I think some people do come into it thinking, right, I've just got to really fucking impress everyone wow them. And actually, it's much more about how are you going to fit into this quite seamlessly? Probably some people do want someone to kind of come in and, you know, whazz a load of solos all over something.
There are bands that definitely want somebody to whazz all over them, for sure. 100%. But no, I think you're right. This sort of, you know, that probably isn't us or most of the musicians we know, to be honest. But
yeah, I suppose it's the way I think about bands as well. Like, I mean, you know, you're doing a solo thing. I just don't think I would ever have... There's actually no way I could do that. There's no way I could have the confidence. But then I think you were saying that when it was working with Thurston that made you think that you could do that.
Yeah, and actually Jem from Thurston's band was like the one who kind of, you know, really... He sort of suggested one night drunkenly that I'd take one of the slots at a club that he puts on, and I drunkenly agreed, thinking not really anything. And even the next day, I'd completely forgotten about it, to be honest, and for several days afterwards, until he mentioned it again and sent me a copy of the poster to agree with, and I was like, oh, what? Thurston introduced me to a whole world of improvisation and things. So through that, I had done improv stuff, which I'd never done before. And I'd always just thought, no way. You know, even the idea, even the word jamming used to freak me out, let alone, you know, actually doing it. So, but Firstness sort of introduced me to a whole lot of ideas. And then Jem kind of held my hand and pushed me through the process of doing solo stuff, including kind of putting a record out and the tour we did in November and things like that, you know. And actually we've just put out a little single together and we're going to go out and tour that, you know. So we're still working together and he's still pulling me through it, dragging me through.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people, I think their idea of musicians is that they're desperate to just muscle in the front and kind of, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people don't realise that actually, you know, a lot are kind of like, no, I'm fine back here, you know.
Yeah, I've written bits and pieces, you know, forever, and I'm quite happy just doing it. And it never, you know, it never occurred to me that actually releasing them validates them any more or any less. You know, they're just there. I enjoy making them and recording them, and, you know. And part of, you know, not releasing them probably is not wanting to sort of put your head above the parapet, for sure. And part of that changes, I think, with age. I sort of perhaps, you know, and it's not that I don't care, but it doesn't worry me in quite the same way what people think about me anymore. Enough friends, and I've...
Also, time's running out.
Yeah, well, that as well. You know, there's barely a month goes by where you don't, you know, there isn't a post about somebody you know quite well or very well or distantly, you know. But there's really, even more than that, I would say, barely every couple of weeks it happens now where you see something, you're like, oh, God, I met them or I know them, or, you know. And it's, yeah, time is short. And, you know, you've been told that all your life, but I'm definitely at a stage where it's becoming more and more evident, I think. So, yeah, so the idea of kind of, you know, sitting back and thinking, oh, I can't do this in case people don't like it, becomes really more and more irrelevant, I think, as you get older.
For sure. And even waiting for the perfect moment, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that actually, even having kids and people I know, you know, where younger people who are thinking of having kids, and I'm always like, just fuck it. If you're going to have them, right? It's never the right fucking time and it's a fucking nightmare, half of it. So just do it, get on with it, right? Like, you know, if you're going to do it.
It's a fucking nightmare.
Well, yeah, it is a bit. I mean, it's wonderful, but yeah, it's like anything, isn't it? It's like anything that you feel is, like, you know, gonna occupy a huge part of your time. It has to be bloody worth it and it has to be wonderful, but it is going to be shit as well, right? You know?
Yeah.
That's my philosophy anyway.
I'll take your word for it. I've never had my own. I've been very lucky in, you know, I've been very close to my ex-girlfriends. I've, you know, been involved in bringing up kids with them, but and they're lovely. But the great thing is, when it gets to those shit points, you can just hand them back.
No shit. You don't know how fucking envious I am.
Yeah. So what's next for you, Mickey?
Oh, I'm going to America in a couple of weeks. Well, I've got my visa interview tomorrow, so...
Oh, nice.
So, fingers crossed. Yeah. They don't make it easy, do you know what I mean? It's like, I've been printing out forms and fucking, crossing T's, dotting I's, all of that, you know. Right. So, yeah, I'm setting off about 7 o'clock in the morning, so we'll see.
Yeah, but, you know, one time I went to the American Embassy and, like, it's always stupid early, isn't it? You always have to be there at 7. And I had a Nick Cave and Warren Ellis were in the queue. And it was something so surreal about seeing them at that time in the morning. I was like, woo.
There is something about that kind of out of context thing.
Yeah, it was really weird. And also because I'm not usually awake at that time, it was like I did think, am I fucking dreaming?
Yeah, I felt much the same way when I went to my Enterprise Allowance interview and the bass player from Loop was there. And I thought, what the fuck?
Thanks for listening to the Talkhouse podcast, and thanks to Mickey Bereny and Debbie Googe for chatting. If you liked what you heard, please follow Talkhouse on your favorite podcasting platform and check out all the good stuff at talkhouse.com. This episode was produced by Myron Kaplan, and the Talkhouse theme is composed and performed by The Range. See you next time.